Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe, and welcome back to this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Today is Monday, September 1st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. Today is Labor Day in the United States, a federally recognized holiday. Earlier this morning was the Labor Day parade that takes place annually in downtown Detroit. Also taking place as well in downtown Detroit is the 35th annual Detroit International Jazz Festival, which today will be the concluding sessions. It's going to be featuring a number of artists, including Stanley Clark, the famous bass player, as well as many others. Joshua Redman, who is the artist in residence for this week's and the 35th anniversary of the Detroit Jazz Festival. And in that spirit, we're going to listen to the sound of the Clifford Brown All-Stars with this tune entitled Autumn in New York. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Azikwe, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Azikwe. Today is Monday, September 1st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We're listening to the music of the Clifford Brown All-Stars with the tune entitled Autumn in New York. And we are broadcasting simultaneously with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, the 35th Detroit International Jazz Festival. And it will be concluding today, September 1st, 2014, Labor Day weekend here in the United States. So stay tuned. We'll be coming up a little bit later on in our program with the Pan-African Newswire, as well as a version, New York City version, of the Pan-African Journal from our vaults, originally recorded earlier this year. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with more of this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. Thank you. welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. We just heard the music of the Clifford Brown All-Stars from the tune entitled Autumn in New York. And the Clifford Brown All-Stars, of course, was a group composed of musicians, including Max Roach on drums, Herb Geller on alto, and Joe Maini on alto as well, and Walter Benton on tenor saxophone, pianist Kenny Drew, bassist Curtis Counts. And that was a tune entitled Autumn in New York. And we're broadcasting today, September 1st, on a Monday, 2014, live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to the Pan-African Journal. If you want to have access to this program, as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network, which can be reached at the following URL. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And in doing that, you can, of course, tune in to the Pan-African Journal, as well as several hundred, approximately 400 archived editions of the Pan-African Journal. And right now, we're going to go into our vaults for the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal that was recorded earlier this year on February 17th of 2014. The New York City version of the Pan-African Journal is hosted by yours truly, Abayomi Ezekwe. But also, it is produced by Bernard White, who is involved with Community Progressive Radio in New York City, CPRMetro.org. So let's listen in to the New York City version of the Pan-African Journal from February 17th, earlier this year. Greetings, this is Abayomi Ezekwe. Welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And in this week's Pan-African Journal, we're going to be dealing with some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day. These are some of the stories that we'll be covering in this week's program. Lawyers for ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi have withdrawn from the military-backed court due to the detention of the Muslim Brotherhood leader and the elected head of state. Meanwhile, a bomb explosion on a tourist bus in the Red Sea town of Taba has reportedly killed at least four people. A white man has been convicted of attempted murder in the shooting death of a Florida 17-year-old African-American youth, Jordan Davis. The jury was hung on the murder charges, which prosecutors say will be refiled. The legacies of leading civil rights and human rights icons such as Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, and Martin Luther King Jr. are being contested in popular culture and through the courts. A tremendous industry has grown up around their images as well as artifacts associated with them and belonging to them. And finally, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has called upon the people to defend the revolution in the South American country. Opposition forces have been demonstrating against the Bolivarian government, where several people have been killed. And our first story deals with the developing political crisis inside the North African state of Egypt. On Sunday, the ousted President Mohamed Morsi appeared in a cage inside a courtroom in Egypt. The lawyers representing the ousted President Mohamed Morsi and 35 other Muslim Brotherhood figures in the Sunday, February the 16th trial for espionage charges has withdrawn their defense team, prompting the court to appoint 10 new attorneys and postpone the trial until February the 23rd. Head of the Morsi defense team, Salim El Awa, said that he objected to the soundproof glass boxes in which the ousted president and other defendants have been forced to remain inside during all the courtroom proceedings. The beginning of Sunday's court session saw Morsi and many other defendants chanting slogans against military rule. They also chanted Egypt's national anthem. The glass boxes were installed so as to prevent, ostensibly, Morsi and other Brotherhood figures from disrupting the various trials they currently face, as they have done repeatedly since their first court appearances during late 2013. Members of the defense team have been inserted inside the glass boxes as per court orders to ensure the defendants are able to hear the trial's proceedings. However, the defense has said that the trial was nearly inaudible from inside Morsi's box and completely blocked out in the boxes of other defendants. El Awa told the state-owned Egyptian news agency Aram Online that his defense team will not attend any future court sessions unless the glass boxes are removed. After El Awa's decision, the court announced it will appoint 10 new lawyers for Morsi and the defendants so that the trial can resume. However, a defense lawyer in the case, Hussein Farouk, told Aram Online that this decision would invalidate the trial, as Morsi and other defendants have only authorized El Sawa's team to represent them. Morsi and the 35 Brotherhood figures stand accused of collaborating with foreign organizations to commit acts of terrorism in Egypt, revealing defense secrets to a foreign country, funding terrorists, and organizing military training to, quote, achieve the purposes of the International Organization of the Brotherhood, end quote, according to a statement from the Egyptian prosecutor's office. The prosecution specifically accuses the Brotherhood members of collaborating with the Gaza-based Hamas group, the Lebanese Shia group, Hezbollah, and other organizations inside and outside of Egypt to smuggle arms, organize military training for groups in the Gaza Strip in Palestine, and fund a scheme to stir chaos and threaten national security in Egypt. Morsi's former presidential aides, including his national security advisor, Issam El Haddad, are accused of divulging secret reports to the Brotherhood's international wings, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, and Hezbollah in return for their cooperation in terrorist operations. The charges against the defendants span the period from 2005 to 2013. The defendants include Brotherhood Supreme Guide Mohamed Badi, former Speaker of Parliament Mohamed El Khatani, and Ahmed Abdel Ati, ex-head of Morsi's presidential office. 19 of the defendants, including Morsi, are already behind bars. The public prosecutor has issued an arrest warrant for the remaining 17 defendants. The defendants in this case have emphatically denied these charges. They, in fact, to some observers, appear to be preposterous. For example, notions of collaboration between the Iranian Revolutionary Guards seem almost unfathomable. Iran and Egypt, even under the Muslim Brotherhood rule, did not have solid fraternal relations. In fact, the former ousted Egyptian president criticized Iran for its support of the Syrian government, of course, as it relates to the U.S.-backed war against that Middle Eastern state. Other news from the North African state of Egypt revolves around a recent attack on a tourist bus in the resort Red Sea town of Taba. An attack on a tourist bus in the Red Sea resort town of Taba, according to reports, has killed at least four people. It is the first terrorist attack on tourists since the January 2011 uprising took place over 3 years ago. The Korean tourist and the Egyptian bus driver was killed, while 14 others were injured in the blast, and it took place on Sunday afternoon, February the 16th. Security sources told Al Aram's correspondents in the South Sinai the details of the attacks. Earlier, security sources had told Aram Arabic news website that the bus was targeted by a missile. However, South Sinai Governor Khalid Fudah told the private satellite television channel CBC-TV that the blast resulted from an explosive device planted on the bus. Fudah stressed that investigations are still underway. Quote, until they are over, we cannot be sure of the cause of the explosion, unquote. Most casualties were taken to Taba and Nuiba hospitals, Aram Arabic reporter Hani El Asma said. While the urgent cases were taken to Sharm el-Sheikh International Hospital, embassies can transfer their nationals via airplane if needed, Tourism Minister Hisham Zazu told the CBC. 30 tourists of various nationalities were on the bus when it was attacked. The authorities have closed off the international road leading to Taba to search for the perpetrators. A pattern of bombings and assassination attempts has been growing since Morsi's ouster. The main targets have been police and military installations in the Sinai Peninsula. There have also been an increased number of attacks in Cairo and the Nile Delta region in recent months. Ansar Biyat al-Maqdis, an al-Qaeda-inspired Islamic militant group based in the Sinai, has taken responsibility for many of the recent attacks taking place in Egypt. The last major attack on tourists in Egypt took place in 2005 when a bomb killed 88 people in Sharm el-Sheikh. The Egyptian tourism industry, once worth more than a tenth of the country's economic output, has been struggling to recover since the 2011 uprising. It has suffered further blows since last summer's political upheaval, which saw the Islamist president, Mohamed Morsi, ousted after mass protests against his rule. Egypt welcomed around 8.7 million tourists in the first 11 months of 2013, compared with 10.5 million in the same period of 2012. In October of 2013, Zazu said that Egypt's aim to attract 13.5 million visitors in 2014 to bring in around $11 billion. Also in regard to developments inside of the North African state of Egypt, Rhonda Ali, an analyst for Aram Online, said that the tourist attack in Egypt may be a turning point. The first terrorist attack on tourists in Egypt in over a decade is raising fears of escalations of tensions as critics point to a police force that is in dire need of restructuring. Beyond the headlines of Sunday's bomb blasts on a bus carrying 33 tourists in the Red Sea resort town of Taba, which killed three South Koreans and the Egyptian bus driver, is the fact that the attack was the first to target tourists in Egypt since 2008. For Imam Raghab, a researcher at the Al-Aram Center for Political and Strategic Studies Center, the attack represents, quote, a new phase, unquote, in Egypt's ongoing battle against terrorism, which has spiked following the ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in July of 2013. Until the Sunday, February 16th attack, however, all of the bomb attacks had targeted only security installations and personnel. Raghib expressed her fear that Sunday's attack might open the door for a wave of terrorism similar to the one that took place in the 1990s, when Egypt was rocked by recurrent militant attacks on tourist sites across the country, which severely crippled tourism and threatened security. In 1997, at least 58 foreigners and four Egyptians were killed by Islamic militants in Upper Egypt's Luxor, a city that boasts a wealth of pharaonic era sites. For Major General Fouad Alam, former deputy head of state security, Sunday, February the 16th attack was no surprise. Alam explained that militant groups are willing to target, quote, whatever helps them achieve their goal in destroying the Egyptian state, which includes targeting its economy, unquote. He added that the attack on civilians is not an escalation by militants, but rather a mere opportunity that terrorists managed to seize. Quote, secret organizations don't have one coherent path that they abide to, unquote, Alam said. Quote, whenever there is a chance for making a terrorist operation, they do it. It's not necessarily targeting tourism or police all the way, unquote. Unlike Alam, Raghab sees the attack as a clear change of strategy by militants in Egypt. They are now trying to increase the cost of damages caused by their attack, she says. Quote, when security buildings were attacked, This was an indicator of a security vacuum in Egypt, unquote, Raghab said. Quote, now when tourism is attacked as well, this would be an indicator that Egypt is not a place for tourists at the moment, unquote. Dave Barnett, a research associate at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, who focuses on Salafi jihadists in Sinai and Gaza, told Aram Online that it remains too early to decide whether Sunday's attack is a start of a new trend targeting tourists. However, Barnett said that if the attack were to be claimed by Ansar Bayt al-Mahdi, the Sinai-based militant group responsible for most of the attacks since Morsi's ouster, that it would signify a shift in its targets' selections. The group considers Egypt's troops as infidels and has frequently urged civilians to avoid venues linked to the police and the military. All of the attacks, it has since claimed, have been on security personnel. No group has yet claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack in Taba. Mahmoud Khoury, a former brigadier general, accused the incompetence of the police for allowing such an attack to take place at all. Khoury has been an outspoken critic of Egypt's security forces. He made the same arguments after the attack on Sunday, February the 16th, insisting that the police apparatus is collapsing as a result of poor leadership and is in desperate need of restructuring. Quote, what happened today is a gross and self-evident mistake, unquote, he said. Quote, how could previously security forces accompanying these tourists not think of checking the bus for explosives beforehand, unquote. South Sinai Governor Khalid Fouda told the private satellite channel CBC TV that the blast resulted from an explosive device planted on the bus. Alam said that he expects militant attacks to continue, but maintained his certainty that security forces, national security, and military intelligence have the upper hand in the fight against the militants, which will soon be completely crushed, he said. Comments are like this are, quote, for Khoury, merely compliments for the police and the ineffectiveness in the long run. Whoever says that terrorism is getting weaker is being silly, unquote, Khoury said. Quote, these groups are highly trained and funded. Quote, Egypt will never succeed without rebuilding the police apparatus once again. If Egypt's leaders continue to depend on Interior Minister Mohamed Ibrahim and his aides, Egypt will fail, unquote. The Egyptian tourism industry, once worth more than a tenth of the country's economic output, has been struggling to recover since the 2011 uprisings. It further deteriorated following last summer's political upheaval that saw the removal of Morsi. In the past, Egypt had welcomed around 8.7 million tourists just in the 7 months of 2013 last year, compared with 10.5 million in the same period the year before in 2012. Tourism Minister Hisham Sawzu said in late January that 2013 was one of the worst years for tourism in the North African state, with the ongoing political unrest and security concerns keeping many visitors away. In October of 2013, Sawzu said that Egypt aimed to attract 13.5 million visitors for this year, 2014, a number which will bring in around $11 billion in tourism revenue. The last major attack on tourism in Egypt took place in 2006 when a bomb killed 23 people, most of them being foreigners, in the laid-back beach town of Dahab in the South Sinai. In 2005, 88 people died in a bomb attack in Sharm el-Sheikh, an hour drive from Dahab and a staple of most package holidays to the country. In 2004, 34 people died and 135 were injured in a bomb blast in Taba as well. And with that, we're going to conclude this segment of the Pan-African Journal, examining recent developments in the North African state of Egypt. We'll be right back with more of this week's program. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. In the southern state of Florida in the United States, a white man was convicted of attempted murder. Although the jury was hung on the murder charges, Michael Dunn was convicted on three counts of attempted second-degree murder, but there is a mistrial on first-degree murder, and the prosecutors say they will seek a new trial in Dunn's situation. Dunn faces the potential of 60 years in prison, possibly 15 more for another charge. The teen killed, Jordan Davis, would have celebrated his 19th birthday on Sunday, February the 16th. Now, a jury on Saturday, February the 15th, during the evening hours, convicted a Florida man on four charges related to his shooting into a SUV full of teenagers during an argument over loud music, but could not decide on the most serious charge, which was murder. Michael Dunn was found guilty on four charges, including three of attempted second-degree murder, which could land him behind bars for decades. Yet, there was no verdict on the first-degree murder charge tied to the death of 17-year-old Jordan Davis. As the jury's decision became clear about 7 p.m. Saturday, Dunn looked ahead solemnly with a frown, but no tears. His lawyer, Corey Stroller, told reporters later that his client was, quote, in disbelief, unquote. Quote, even as he sat next to me, he asked, how is this happening, unquote, Stroller said. It has not set in. I don't think it will set in anytime soon, unquote. The incomplete finale to this hot-button trial, emotionally charged partly because of the fact that Dunn is white and the teenagers who were shot at, including Davis, are African-Americans, echoed George Zimmerman's trial for the killing of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin about 120 miles south in Sanford, Florida. While the state's stand-your-ground law wasn't used by Dunn, his lawyers did argue that he fired in self-defense. Given the partially hung jury, State Attorney Angela Corey said prosecutors would press for a new trial in Duval County on the murder charges. Quote, justice for Jordan Davis is as important as it is for any victim, unquote, said Corey, whose office also handled the Zimmerman case. Even without a final decision on the murder count and pending defense appeals, the 47-year-old Dunn is looking at a lengthy prison term. Prosecutor Aaron Wolfson explained Saturday night that each attempt of second-degree murder convictions carries a minimum sentence of at least 20 years. There's also a 15-year sentence possibly on a conviction for shooting into the teenager's vehicle. Quote, you are looking basically at life in prison, unquote, Stroller said, even as he vowed to challenge the convictions. Quote, at 47 years old, that's a life sentence, regardless of count one, unquote. Now, various news analysts, including a CNN analyst, Paul Kalin, said in most cases, prosecutors will take some time after a mistrial to reflect on the case before planning the next phase. Quote, if he winds up with 60 or 75 years in jail, from a pragmatic standpoint, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to retry the case, unquote, he said on Sunday, February the 16th, which would have been Davis's 19th birthday. Quote, on the other hand, if you're the parents of Jordan Davis and you believe, as well as you should, that your son's reputation has been besmirched by the self-defense claim, the family might want a retrial, and that's something that a prosecutor has to consider carefully. Hopefully, Corey will look carefully at the pluses and the minuses of doing a retrial, unquote. A decision to convict on all these counts and not on murder didn't come easily for a jury that had deliberated for about 30 hours since getting the cases late Wednesday. Judge Russell Healy acknowledged earlier Saturday on February the 15th that the jury of four white women and two black women and four white men, an Asian woman and a Hispanic man, was, quote, struggling, obviously, unquote. Quote, but it's not for want of trying to reconcile all of this, unquote, he said then. Quote, I think we've got some analytical people in there who are trying to do just that, trying to analyze this from every possible angle, unquote. The lack of a murder conviction upset some, including protesters who marched outside the Jacksonville courthouse calling for Corey to lose her job. Quote, "People United will never be defeated," unquote, they chanted. But Davis's mother, Lucia McBath, didn't express any anger when she addressed reporters Saturday night. Her family, she said, is, quote, "so very happy to have just a little bit of closure," unquote. Quote, "It's sad for Mr. Dunn that he will live the rest of his life in that sense of torment, and I will pray for him," unquote, McBath said. Quote, "And I've asked my family to pray for him," unquote. Now, it was November 23rd of 2012 when Michael Dunn pulled into a gas station in Jacksonville, Florida, parking next to a red Dodge Durango with four teenagers inside. The teens had come in for gums and cigarettes. Dunn, meanwhile, had just left his son's wedding with his fiancée, who'd gone inside the convenience store for wine and chips. Dunn didn't like the loud music, quote, "rap crap," unquote, as he called it, coming from the teens' SUV. So he asked them to turn it down. What followed next depends on whom you believe. Dunn says Davis threatened him, and he decided to take matters into his own hands upon seeing what he thought was a barrel of a gun sticking out of the Durango. But prosecutors say it was Dunn who lost control, firing three volleys of shots, 10 bullets in total, at the SUV over music he didn't like. Prosecutors challenged what he did next. He left the gas station and drove to his hotel about 3 miles away. There, Dunn walked his dog, ordered a pizza, then drank rum and cola. Quote, "stunned and horrified, things escalated the way they did over a common courtesy," unquote. After learning almost 6 hours later that he had killed Davis, Dunn testified that he became, quote, "crazy with grief," unquote, experiencing stomach problems for more than 4 hours before taking a nap. Quote, "my intent was to stop the attack, not necessarily end a life," unquote, he testified. Quote, "it's just worked out that way," unquote. Yet his fiancée, Rhonda Raur, testified that Dunn had never mentioned any weapon to her, be it a shotgun, a stick, a barrel, or a lead pipe. In fact, police found a base basketball, basketball shoes, clothing, a camera, a tripod, and cups inside the teenager's Durango, and there was no gun. Dunn himself never called the police. The first contact he had with the police was at his home in Satellite Beach as he was being apprehended. Arguing that he wasn't in a rational state of mind, Dunn admitted, quote, "it makes sense that I should have contacted the authorities. We didn't. I can't tell you why," unquote. Now, this case echoes the similar trial of George Zimmerman during 2013 for the cold-blooded 2012 murder of a 17-year-old African-American Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. Some people were quick to compare Dunn to Zimmerman, who ultimately was acquitted of murder for the shooting of 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. Martin's own parents were among them, claiming Davis's killing is another reminder that in Florida, quote, racial profiling and stereotypes, unquote, may serve as the basis for illegitimate fear and the shooting and killing of young teenagers. But Dunn's defense attorney, Stroller, told the international media on Friday, February the 14th, that the Zimmerman and the Dunn cases aren't so similar. There was a physical confrontation between Zimmerman and Martin, and police gave Zimmerman the benefit of the doubt about defending himself, Stroller said. Quote, "my client did not wait to become that victim," unquote, he said. Quote, "my client did not wait to either get assaulted by a weapon or have someone potentially pull a trigger," unquote, he said. Though a weapon was never found, Stroller maintains the youths could have had one and somehow ditched it. He said the key point was that Dunn believed they were armed and that his life was in danger. Quote, "now, does it sound irrational? Of course it sounds irrational. But have you ever been in that situation?" unquote, the lawyer asked. Stroller said on Saturday, February the 15th, that the four convictions leave him with regret, even as he said he couldn't immediately think of anything he'd do differently in the case. At the same time, the prosecution didn't manage a conviction on what was by far the largest charge of first-degree murder. Quote, "everybody's lost something in this," unquote, the lawyer said. His client, quote, "will live to fight another day," unquote, in court but he and his loved ones are suffering now, Stoller said. He acknowledged, too, the pain felt by the Davis family. And in the Fight Back News website, there was another article written on the case involving the prosecution of Michael Dunn for the murder of Jordan Davis. The article was written by Fernando Figueroa, and it says that the steps of the Duval County Courthouse were filled with protesters and community members on Saturday, February the 15th. They waited to hear the verdict in the trial to convict Michael Dunn for murdering Jordan Davis. Groups ranging from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the New Black Panther Party, to the Jacksonville Progressive Coalition held up signs, and they gave speeches demanding justice. They marched around the courthouse. The day of the protests began with a 9 a.m. press conference and lasted long into the evening. So many people showed up throughout the day, it was hard to find a spot to sit or stand on the giant steps leading to the courthouse. Inside the court, the jury was deliberating for a fourth day over the November 23rd, 2012 murder of Jordan Davis. Jordan Davis and his friends were in their Dodge Durango outside a Jacksonville gas station when Dunn fired eight times into their vehicle. Michael Dunn, a white man, drove over, parked next to them, and then brutally murdered Jordan Davis in cold blood, quote, for playing his music too loud, unquote. Now, all week long outside the courtroom, organizers and everyday working people, especially African-American community members, gathered eagerly awaiting justice. Everyone was there to demand that Michael Dunn be found guilty of all charges, especially the charge for first-degree murder. Sunday, February the 16th, would have been Jordan Davis's 19th birthday. Surely a difficult day for his parents. And with that, we're going to conclude this report on the conviction of Michael Dunn for the killing of Jordan Davis. He was convicted of attempted murder, and state prosecutors say that they will refile the case on first-degree murder charges. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We're going to take another break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's program.
Until the killing of black men, mother's son is as important as the killing of white men. White mother's son, do you believe in freedom and not rest? Sing it with me if you like.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. February is African American History Month. Of course, this year represents the 38th anniversary of the proclamation of Black History Month in 1976. The 1976 proclamation of Black History Month recognized the 50th anniversary of Negro History Week, which was founded by Dr. Carter G. Woodson, a Harvard graduate and historian who founded the Association for the Study of Negro Life and History in 1915, and also founded the Journal of Negro History in 1916. Dr. Carter Woodson died in 1950 at the age of 75. However, during this month, there has been much controversy surrounding some leading figures in African American history over their legacies as well as their artifacts. Now, Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter recently walked up to the pulpit of the Atlanta church where her father preached, and in a painful public display, disassociated herself from her brothers. According to an Associated Press article, she accused them of plotting to sell their father's personal Bible and his Nobel Peace Prize items she declared, quote, sacred, unquote, and worth more than money. When it comes to fights like this, the Kings are not alone. Malcolm X's daughters are suing to block a book deal signed by one of the sisters to publish their father's diary. Rosa Parks' valuable mementos, including her Presidential Medal of Freedom and Congressional Gold Medal of Honor, have sat in a New York City warehouse for years because of a protracted battle over her estate. America's greatest civil rights leaders may belong to the ages, but the fights among family, friends, and outsiders over control of their earthly possessions seems to be never-ending. Unsavory as they may appear, fights like these are not unique and are exacerbated by the moral heft of the leader's life work and the fact that their belongings could be worth millions. With each court battle, civil rights historians worry about the negative impact such infighting might have on the legacy of the civil rights movement. Neither Malcolm X nor King, killed in 1965 and 1968 respectively, left wills, so there are no specifics about what they wanted done with their belongings. The strong widows who built legacies for them and who could enforce peace in the family through matriarchal fiat are also gone. Betty Shabazz, who made her transition in 1997, and Coretta Scott King, who passed in 2006. Not even a long life and careful planning are enough to quell such disputes. Parks, who died in 2005 in Detroit at the age of 92, stipulated in her will that her belongings go to a charitable foundation, the Rosa and Raymond Parks Institute for Self-Development, based in the city of Detroit. Parks had no children, but her nieces and nephews challenged her will, and this fight has left her valuable possessions in limbo for nearly a decade. King, Parks, and Malcolm X were not wealthy people in life, so their families have a right to be concerned about the financial value of their famous relatives' legacy, said John A. Powell, director of the Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society at the University of Berkeley, at the University of California at Berkeley. Quote, somebody is going to make money off their names, unquote, Powell said. You just hope people do it with a certain amount of dignity, unquote. Few would say that it happened. Many point to the King family's public feuds as evidence that it has not. Quote, to be fighting over money and profit is to dishonor everything their father stood for, unquote, said Deborah E. McDowell, a director of the Carter G. Woodson Institute for African-American and African Studies at the Alice Griffin Professor, who is an Alice Griffin Professor at the University of Virginia. Most families only have to deal with a parent's estate once, but when the parent in question was a beloved historic figure, there regularly are new issues to address, said lawyer Andrew Daniel Mayoris, who wrote a book about famous estate battles. Quote, there can always be a new project that the family is approached with or a new item someone decides to sell, unquote, said Andrew Mayoris, who specializes in probate matters. Quote, so yes, for these families, we do think it's going to keep on going on and on, sadly, unquote. Many American families go through the same thing, said Danielle Mayoris, an estate attorney. Quote, sometimes they are fighting over the Christmas ornaments instead of diaries that might be very valuable, but oftentimes, what we see is that it's not the value of the item, it's the sentimental attachment or the emotion that's involved, unquote, she said. Now, Martin III, Dexter, and Bernice King have fought in the courts for years, going after their father's friends and fellow activists in addition to each other. The family has sent numerous cease and desist letters to stop various uses of King's written work and images and followed up with the court actions if they weren't satisfied with the results. Last year, they sued Andrew Young, a King confidant who helped their father coordinate civil rights efforts throughout the South, over footage of King that shows up in a series produced by the Andy Young Foundation. The King children acted in 2008 to block actor and singer Harry Belafonte from auctioning documents that their parents had given to Belafonte years earlier, leading Belafonte to sue the younger Kings last year in hopes of determining legal ownership. Young has said that King's lawsuit doesn't bother him because the question of rightful ownership does need to be sorted out, especially because certain aspects of King's legacy belongs to him as well. Lawyers on both sides of the Belafonte lawsuit did not return telephone calls seeking comment. Court papers indicate a settlement is being pursued. The King heirs even have used the courts to fight each other. In 2008, Bernice and Martin III sued Dexter, accusing him of acting improperly as head of their father's estate. The three reached a private settlement in October of 2009. Now they're back in court again, with Martin III and Dexter suing Bernice over her possession of their father's Bible and his 1964 Nobel Peace Prize medal. Both items are likely to gain value. The 50th anniversary of King's Nobel Peace Prize will take place later on this year, and King's personal Bible was used to swear in President Barack Obama during his second inauguration January of 2013. Bernice King refused to turn them over, saying her brothers want to sell them, just as the three of them have sold other items that belong to their father. Quote, "I take this strong position for my father because Daddy is not here to say himself. My Bible and my medals are never to be sold, not as an institution or even a person," unquote, she said during a news conference this month at Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church. Her brothers, who run King's estate, have not responded publicly to their sister's complaints. It's the same for Rosa Parks as well as Malcolm X. Because of infighting, a trove of Rosa Parks memorabilia, unseen writings from a young Rosa Parks, mementos from world leaders who honored her, and family artifacts sits unsold in Guernsey's auction house in New York City waiting for a buyer. Guernsey's can't sell the material piecemeal because, after much legal wrangling, a judge ordered it sold together. No museum, foundation, or private collector has met the $10 million price for the entire collection, said Arlon Ettinger, president of Guernsey's. Last year, the family of Malcolm X successively blocked Chicago-based Third World Press from publishing diaries from his pilgrimage to Mecca and his travels across the Middle East and Africa in 1964, some 50 years ago. Matthew D. Brickenhoff, lawyer for Third World Press, said in court papers that the publisher has signed a contract from one of Malcolm X's six daughters, Ilyasa Shabazz, making her siblings' complaint moot. The company created by the activist children, X Legacy LLC, indicated in court papers that it plans to publish the diaries to coincide with next year's 50th anniversary of Malcolm X's assassination. Also, just this last past week, pop star Nicki Minaj came under tremendous criticism for the utilization of a photograph of Malcolm X holding a rifle during the period of the last months of his life when he was being threatened with death. This photograph has become iconic over the years. Nicki Minaj utilized the photograph to promote a new recording. And of course, using the N-word provoked outrage. And of course, she was forced to make an apology for what was described as an exploitative utilization of the image of Malcolm X. And of course, these conflicts surrounding iconic civil rights and black nationalist leaders will continue. The commodification of images and mementos and artifacts and even writings of these historic figures have become a multi-million dollar industry. Of course, we will continue to cover these developments through the Pan-African Journal. And right now, we'll take another break, and we'll be right back with more of this week's Pan-African Journal.
If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. Every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question.
And welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis, and I'm your host, Abayomi Azikwe. In the South American nation of Venezuela, thousands of supporters of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro marched in central Caracas on Saturday February the 15th, to call for peace and to make a show of political strength after last week's deadly violence at various street protests inside the country. In a prosperous eastern part of the capital, at least 1,000 protesters gathered to demand the president's resignation, denouncing him over grievances ranging from political repression to daily issues such as inflation, shortages of basic products, and rampant crime. Almost a year after succeeding the late Hugo Chavez, President Maduro accuses his rivals of stoking unrest to try to stage a coup like the one that was carried out 12 years ago that briefly ousted President Hugo Chavez. There are, however, no indications the current turmoil could lead to his ouster. Quote, "You want to see people in the streets? We'll give you people in the streets," the president said, to a loud applause and cheers of, quote, "No to fascism," unquote, at the rally. Addressing the crowd from a pastel-colored stage displaying the slogan, quote, "People of peace," unquote, he mocked the demands of the protesters who want him to step down. Quote, "I'm not going to give up one millimeter of power the Venezuelan people have given me. Nothing will stop me from building this revolution which Comandante Chavez left us," unquote. Later on Friday, February the 14th, police used tear gas and water cannon to clear some 1,000 protesters from the Altamira Square in eastern Caracas, where some of them had lit trash bonfires in blocked streets. The protesters are vowing to defy Maduro's ban on unauthorized demonstrations, put in place after three people were shot dead this week after an opposition-led demonstration. On Saturday, February the 15th, supporters of the opposition gathered again to sing and chant slogans in the square. Many then set off to block a major highway, as they had done briefly the night before. Quote, "They say we're rich kids, but I'm from a humble family," unquote, said Joseph Sandoval, a 24-year-old student. Quote, "I represent the majority of Venezuelans who are sick of seeing our country sinking like this," unquote. Nearby, another student, Michael Paredes, who is 26 years old, carried a bag with vinegar and a bandana to protect against tear gas. Quote, "People are asleep," unquote, Paredes said. Quote, "It's time for action," unquote. Now, Maduro said in his speech that he had ordered the temporary closure of the metro station and suspension of bus services in the east of the city where the protests are centered. The protesters blame Maduro for a host of complaints ranging from fast rising cost of living, shortages of basic products and stores, and one of the highest murder rates in the world. Demonstrations that end in bloodshed could, however, play into the president's hands by helping him unite factions within the ruling Socialist Party of Bolivarian Venezuela, divide the opposition coalition where many questions the wisdom of the street tactics, and distract people from the economic problems still persisting inside the country. Venezuela's state prosecutor said that 25 of the 99 people arrested in connection with last week's violence had been freed pending trial, and that the others would be processed within hours. Maduro, who is a tall, 51-year-old former bus driver and union leader, has stacked his presidency on maintaining Chavez's radical form of socialism. He says Venezuela faces, quote, an economic war, unquote, waged by the U.S.-backed opposition forces, backed by U.S. financiers, and, of course, made worse by domestic speculators. Supporters say he is the victim of Western imperialist propaganda and saboteurs seeking to discredit the legacy of the late Comandante Hugo Chavez. Quote, "We have to celebrate the revolution, which is love and peace," unquote, said Caina Lovera, a 16-year-old wearing a white T-shirt emblazoned with the late leader's face. Maduro's critics say he is wrecking the economy by sticking with failed Chavez-era socialist policies, such as currency and price controls, which many local economists blame for the shortages prevailing inside the country. Among those critics is hardline opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez, whom the government calls the, quote, "face of fascism," unquote, and the intellectual author of The Violence. The 42-year-old U.S.-educated economist says peaceful marches organized by his Popular Will Party have been infiltrated by provocateurs and attacked by militant pro-government forces known as the colectivos, unquote. Lopez remains in his home in the Chicago district in eastern Caracas, where he was once mayor, colleagues said, despite a judge's arrest warrant to pick him up. It was not immediately clear why police had not acted on the warrant, though such a move could fuel further protest. Maduro demanded on Saturday that Lopez turn himself in. Quote, the opposition organizes these violent groups, and then they hide and cry, unquote, the president said. Quote, you fugitive from justice, trembling with fear, you fascist coward, hand yourself in, unquote, said the president in a speech to his followers. Now, supporters and opponents of the Venezuelan president Nicolas Maduro took to the streets last week in rival demonstrations. The demonstrations come at a time of growing political tensions inside the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. Three people were reported killed during the anti-government protests that occurred on Wednesday of last week, and some 100 students were arrested in the unrest. Mr. Maduro is accusing the opposition of stirring up trouble as part of a coup plot and urged all supporters of the Bolivarian Revolution to march for peace. And of course, this occurred on Saturday, February the 15th. Government supporters began arriving at Venezuela Square in central Caracas during the early morning hours on Saturday, February the 15th. They were dressed predominantly in the colors of red, which demonstrates their support for the Bolivarian Revolution, the colors being blue, yellow, and red. Hours later, Maduro addressed thousands of his supporters in Bolivar Avenue. The march was broadcast live on national television. Quote, I call all the people to the streets in order to defend peace, the president said. He warned that his government would not give in to those who described as, quote, fascist, unquote, including former president of the neighboring Colombia, Alvaro Uribe. Quote, Alvaro Uribe is behind this, financing and directing these fascist movements. He intends to use a Venezuelan television channel, NTN24, to do the same thing that they did on April the 11th of 2002, unquote, the President Maduro said, referring to a failed military coup against the late President Hugo Chavez. Mr. Uribe, a center-right politician, was a fierce enemy of Mr. Chavez and accused the late president of supporting Colombia's largest rebel group, the Armed Forces, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC. Mr. Maduro said police had been looking for opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez, accused of ordering, quote, all these violent kids which he trained to destroy half of Caracas to then go into hiding, unquote. Mr. Lopez has not been seen in public since an arrest warrant was issued for him on Wednesday of last week. United States Secretary of State John Kerry has issued a statement expressing concern about the rising tensions in Venezuela. Quote, we are particularly alarmed by reports that the Venezuelan government has arrested or detained scores of anti-government protesters and issued an arrest warrant for opposition leader Leopoldo Lopez, unquote, read the statement. Opposition demonstrators, including a movement known as Mothers in White, gathered at Las Mercedes neighborhood in eastern Caracas. Thousands of people, mostly wearing white, the opposition colors, marched towards the Court of Justice building and stopped for a memorial ceremony to the three demonstrators who were killed on Wednesday of last week, Marcel Da Costa, Juan Matonio, and Robert Redmond. Student leader Enrique Altamari said the main aim of their, quote, peaceful protest, unquote, was to, quote, pay tribute to the victims, unquote. Now, he said the march would end before night fell to avoid a repeat of the incidents that occurred on Wednesday of last week. The three victims were shot dead by what was described as unknown gunmen as the opposition marches came to an end. Quote, the streets at night are not safe, a safe place for us. We would not be achieving any goal and would only fall in the trap set up by violent pro-government groups, unquote, Mr. Altamari said. The opposition march ended before dusk with clashes between police who fired tear gas in attempts to disperse the crowd and demonstrators who hurled stones at the security forces. Reports say that three people were injured in these clashes, which took place on Saturday, February the 15th. The main opposition grievances are that high inflation, crime, and a shortage of some staple goods has characterized the economic situation inside the country. The government has blamed the shortages on what they call saboteurs and profit-hungry, corrupt businessmen who support the opposition and who are backed by the United States State Department. Venezuelan politics has become increasingly polarized in the last several years. Mr. Maduro was elected last April by a narrow margin, defeating the center-right candidate, Henrique Capriles, who denounced the elections as being fraudulent. A former union leader, Mr. Maduro, was a close ally of President Hugo Chavez, who died of cancer last March after 14 years in office. Mr. Capriles says the government's left-wing policies have led to economic collapse, including high inflation, 56.2% in 2013, according to official figures. And of course, the Venezuelan revolution has always been a target of U.S. imperialism. Since 1998 and 1999, when the Bolivarian Revolution claimed state power with the ascendancy of President Hugo Chavez, there have been numerous attempts to destabilize and overthrow the Bolivarian Revolutionary Government. Of course, in recent months, the U.S. has leveled unprincipled criticism at the Venezuelan government. Of course, this criticism will continue, and President Maduro of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela has proclaimed his willingness to fight the counter-revolution with the assistance of the majority of the people inside that South American country. And with that, we're going to conclude this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal. And in concluding this week's edition of the Pan-African Journal, we'd like to recap the major stories in the Pan-African Journal for this week. Lawyers for ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi have withdrawn from the military-backed court due to the detention of the Muslim Brotherhood leader in a cage. Meanwhile, a bomb explosion on a tourist bus in the Red Sea resort town of Taba has reportedly killed at least four people. A white man has been convicted of attempted murder in the shooting death of a 17-year-old African-American youth in Jacksonville, Florida, Jordan Davis. The jury was hung on the murder charges. However, the prosecutor says that the charges of murder will be refiled by the state. The legacies of leading civil rights and human rights icons such as Malcolm X, Rosa Parks, and Martin Luther King Jr. are being contested in popular culture and also through the courts. A tremendous industry has grown up around their images and the artifacts in which they are associated with. And finally, Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has called upon the people of that South American country to defend the Bolivarian Revolution. Opposition forces that are backed by the United States have been demonstrating against the Bolivarian government, where several people have been killed over the last week. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire, which the Pan-African Journal is based upon, is an international electronic press service designed to foster intelligent discussion on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998 and has published thousands of articles and dispatches in newspapers, in magazines, in journals, in research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. And if you want to log on to the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is log on to panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off for another week. And of course, have a beautiful, beautiful week. Thank you. Greetings once again and welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Monday, September 1st, 2014, Labor Day in the United States. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. And we're also broadcasting simultaneously with the Detroit International Jazz Festival, the 35th anniversary of the Detroit International Jazz Festival. And we are covering that festival this weekend. And, of course, we'll be coming up in just a few more minutes' time with some special features related to the history and legacy of African Americans in which jazz music and other forms of popular culture emerged from in the United States. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal. We heard the music of Jerry Allen, jazz artist. And, of course, as we mentioned before, this weekend, the Detroit International Jazz Festival is taking place in the city of Detroit. An annual event that is held over the Labor Day weekend has been held since 1980. And, of course, it represents one of the cultural highlights of the city of Detroit. And right now, we're going to move into a special Pan-African Journal audio documentary news feature focusing on the history of the so-called Great Migration, the movement of millions of African Americans from the southern and rural sections of the United States to the urban Midwest, North, as well as western parts of the United States. The Great Migration, of course, had its impact as well on a cultural level. The influence of these migratory patterns on African American music, dance, poetry, and other forms of theatrical as well as visual arts were pronounced and have been documented quite extensively throughout the last several decades. This documentary, of course, focuses on the Great Migration of African people in the United States during the period of legalized segregation, commonly known as Jim Crow. And let's listen in to this documentary on the Great Migration.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with Isabel Wilkerson, epic tale-teller of the Great Migration of Southern Blacks that remade America. Sound and spirit, North, South, East, and West in the 20th century. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This is a global story in that the world has seen many mass migrations of very poor farm people, peasants, and serfs toward opportunity. In India and China today, more people migrate from village to city in 1 year than moved with our great migration over 50 years. More than 10 million in Asia every year now, fewer than 10 million in America between 1915 and 1970. That is from World War I to the end of the Civil Rights era, as Isabel Wilkerson has framed her story. But was there ever a migration that, beyond moving people, transformed a national culture as ours did? Songs, games, language, art, style, worship, every kind of entertainment, including pro sports. In fact, almost all we feel about ourselves, how we look to the world, changed in the sweep of this story. Isabel Wilkerson, you're getting so much praise for this book, The Warmth of Other Suns, but I want to add my admiration and thanks. It is a magnificent work, and it's changing me too, Isabel.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm getting ahead of your story, but can we just lay it down here that great swaths of pop and serious culture, the culture I grew up in and my children as well, was fruit of your story. Jazz and its stars like Louis Armstrong, Nat King Cole, Illinois Jacquet, the Basie and the Ellington Bands, stars like Johnny Hodges, whose family moved from Virginia to Boston very early in this century, so many more, Ray Charles, Mahalia Jackson, gospel music, rhythm and blues, the Motown sound, sports immortals like Bill Russell and Jackie Robinson. They're all players in this story. Writers, actors, comedians, Toni Morrison, Spike Lee, Miles Davis, Michelle Obama, they're all children of the Great Migration. Let's listen to Ray Charles singing Georgia, written by Hoagy Carmichael, a white guy, but it's sort of a universal hymn to nostalgia.
Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through,
the whole day,
just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Georgia on my mind.
I said, Georgia, Georgia, a song of you. Come there, sweet and clear, is moonlight through the pines.
When you mention high art, for example, the idea of Toni Morrison, who's a perfect example of this. Toni Morrison's parents were raised in Alabama. They decided they wanted their daughter to go to school and to grow up in the North. They moved to Lorain, Ohio, where she had the opportunity to go to better schools, integrated schools, and to a library. African Americans during a great portion of the 20th century were not able to even walk into a library and take out a book. Where would she be had her parents not had the forethought and the courage to take her out, where she would have the opportunity to read and read and read, take out books, and then to go on to become a Nobel laureate? It's unfathomable. The names
Where
would we be? James
Where
Baldwin.
Would we be without Coltrane?
Just in the literature, James Baldwin, Richard Wright, Ralph Ellison, August Wilson, the playwright, Lorraine Hansberry, another playwright. These people, essentially, their entire art was built around an attempt to understand the Great Migration as they saw it, as the children of this migration. It's really, it's overwhelming when you think of just high art. Then when you get to music.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't you be true?
Connect Chuck Berry to the migration.
Well, Chuck Berry also came up from the South, and he ended up being connected with Chess Records in Chicago and recorded for them. And in some ways, this is an example of the transfer of folk music from the South with the rhythms of the North, the metabolism that's sped up. You can hear that it's a sped-up version, very urban, very fast-paced, and he became a representative, too, of how it mutated in some ways. The art form mutated to become a whole new art form, and he was one of the early participants in rock and roll, which also crossed the Atlantic and came back to us in the form of the Rolling Stones or Eric Clapton and many others.
I think it was Clapton who said about rock and roll, they could have just called it Chuck Berry.
Music, as we know it, would simply not be what it is had there not been the Great Migration. For example, Motown simply wouldn't exist. And that's because Berry Gordy, the founder of Motown, his parents were raised in Georgia. They moved to Detroit, where he grew up. When he became a young man, he decided he wanted to go into the music industry. He didn't have the resources to go scouting all over the country. He looked around himself in the neighborhood where he happened to be, and he saw around him, young people, Diana Ross, whose parents migrated from different parts of the South. The Temptations had all come up from Alabama. Aretha Franklin, her parents came up from the South. The Jackson Five, their mother came from Alabama and their father from Arkansas. They met in the North and then had nine children, who all of whom were musical prodigies, essentially, and changed the face of music as we know it. Prince, often not thought of because his father migrated from Louisiana to Minnesota, which was the far end of that migration north along the midsection of the country. It is hard to imagine American music without this migration having occurred. And we haven't even gotten to the issue of jazz, which you mentioned earlier.
Could we listen to just a little bit of Miles Davis's So What from the Kind of Blue album? Thank you. Miles is so special. Even more so every day somehow. Who is he to you?
Well, he's a legend. And he could not possibly have reached the full realization of his genius had his parents not had the foresight to leave Arkansas, cotton country of Arkansas. However, he also was the beneficiary of the music of the South, because one of the great things about the Great Migration is that it transferred the blues, the spirituals, gospel, the folk music of the South, which had an opportunity to grow in with the metabolism of the North and become a new art form, new art forms in general, rhythm and blues, jazz. And he's a perfect example of one of the best-known people who ever participated in this and benefited.
It's phenomenal. We have, if we talked about sports figures, we'd be here all day and night for weeks. But there are so many important ones. For me, Bill Russell, as a Bostonian, I mean, 13 years in the NBA, 11 national championships. I had not realized, because we thought of him as coming from San Francisco, I had not realized that Bill Russell, too, is a child of the migration from Monroe, Louisiana, where another of your central characters comes from. But dilate a little bit on the great Bill Russell.
Bill Russell would not be who we know him to be had there been no great migration, had his parents not had the courage to leave. His parents were having a very rough go of it in Monroe, Louisiana. They lived under a caste system. This great migration was essentially a defection. It was a seeking of political asylum in a way from a caste system that controlled their every move. From the moment they woke up in the morning to the moment they went to bed, their every movement was determined by this caste system known as Jim Crow. And Bill Russell's family experienced some of the harsh realities of that. And one story involving Bill Russell's father involves a day where Bill Russell's father was just wanting to get gas. And the custom in the Jim Crow South was that when an African American was in line for something, any white Southerner who came up could cut in line and go before that person. So he had been in line for a while, and it turned out that one white motorist after another showed up, got in front of him, and he had to wait, and he had to wait, and he had to wait. Eventually, he decided he would just back out and make the decision to maybe drive the other half hour to the next gas station and where he might be able to get served. As he was beginning to back out, the owner of the gas station stopped pumping gas for the white motorist he was working with and got a shotgun, held it to Bill Russell's father's head, and said, "You'll leave when I tell you to leave. Don't ever let me see you trying that again." His mother, Bill Russell's mother, was around the same time stopped on the street because she was dressed in her Sunday clothes, which she had worked very hard to save for, and a police officer stopped her and said, "You go home right now and take that off. That is not what a colored woman should be wearing." She had to go home. She was told that if she was seen in that again, she would be arrested. Bill Russell came home. He was about 8 or 9 years old, and he saw his mother crying at the kitchen table. The family decided that they would leave Monroe, Louisiana, a very difficult decision, for a faraway place, Oakland, California. And it was there that Bill Russell had the opportunity to go to integrated schools, to be able to go to an NCAA school. He would never have had the opportunity to do that had they stayed in the South. He ended up leading the Dons of the University of San Francisco to 2 NCAA championships, and then, of course, came to the attention of the Celtics, where he helped lead that team to 11 championships out of the 13 years he was there. Basketball, but would not be what we know it to be had this great migration not occurred. And he's but one person out of this entire experience of 6 million people who migrated.
Isabel Wilkerson is my guest. She's made it her 15-year project to understand a 50-year migration of black people out of the South to places like New York, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and California. It was a search, in her title, for the warmth of other suns. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude. Isabel Wilkerson is our guest. The Warmth of Other Suns is her account of a leaderless 50-year revolution. At the start in 1915, 9 out of 10 black Americans lived in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, half of black America lived someplace else. Isabel Wilkerson won a Pulitzer Prize for her New York Times reporting. She now teaches journalism at Boston University. There are so many parables here, Isabel Wilkerson, and I just want to get to a few of them. And the extraordinary thing about your book is that each story is different. Each person had to decide on their own, kind of in isolation, that they'd had enough, or this was the moment to go, or that it was worth it. They argued it out, you know, couples and families entirely on their own over a 50-year period. It's an amazing story. I want to get to the three lives that you followed in the most extraordinary detail. Ida Mae Gladney, George Starling, Ida Mae Gladney being a sharecropper's wife in Mississippi, George Starling being a fruit picker in Orange Blossom, Florida, who ends up coming north and working on the railroad, and then Robert Pershing Foster, coming from relative privilege, goes to Los Angeles as a doctor. He saves Ray Charles's career in a certain way with a surgery when Ray needed it bad. Touched any number of other lives. But where's to begin? I mean, we'll never cover the whole of it, and yet the theme of talent being given a chance and then blossoming in the most spectacular, historic ways runs through this whole book.
Well, I am moved by the idea that this is a leaderless revolution. In other words, there was no one who told these people to make this decision. There was no one who set the day and the time as to when people would go. And these people, in isolation, decided that it was time to go. Ida Mae Gladney, who was, as you said, the wife of a sharecropper, they left because a cousin had been wrongly accused of a theft he had not committed. And when, after her husband had seen what had happened to his cousin, he was beaten to within an inch of his life. And after that, her husband came home and said to her, "This is the last crop we're making." They left Mississippi at night without having told anyone except her mother that they were leaving, and they headed to the Midwest, ultimately landing in Chicago. So that was one.
Introduce George Starling, an obsessively interesting man, tragic in certain ways, but a fighter from conception, it would seem.
It would seem. He had a brief time of being able to go to college, which only made him, I think, more frustrated than anything else, and he was forced to return to picking citrus, which was the primary industry in his part of Florida. Once he got there, because he'd had some education, and he was quite smart, actually, he was valedictorian of his high school class, segregated though it was, he ended up having tremendous frustration over the fact that the work was dangerous and the pay was worse. And he began to lead efforts among these pickers to do work stoppages in order to get a nickel more per box, one nickel more per box for boxes that were ultimately going to go for $3 or $4 on the open market. And it turned out that he had to flee for his life because of threats against his life. He headed to Harlem as a result of those threats. And he ended up working the railroad where he saw the migration unfold before him on the Silver Comet and the Silver Spur and the other trains going back and forth, the migration trains, you might call it. And then finally, we have Dr. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, who had served his country in the Korean War, had served as a surgeon for the Army. When he got out, however, it turned out he could not practice surgery in his own hometown of Monroe, Louisiana, again the home of Bill Russell. And he set out on a course for California, as had Bill Russell's parents. He found that it was a treacherous journey, one he had not anticipated being so difficult. He ended up having to drive three states without rest because he could not find a place that would give him a room.
You drove that route yourself. He did it in the Buick Roadmaster in 1951, I think it was. El Paso was a great, difficult crossing. For you, what were the most treacherous moments in that ride west in the 1950s, yesterday.
Yes, well, I made the journey, you know, well after that, when we could have stopped anywhere we wanted to. I had my parents in the car with me. They were migrants themselves. They had migrated from the South to Washington, D.C., and they were retired by then and always up for an adventure. And we set out on a course with the caveat that I had to be the one driving. But then we got to the dangerous part of the journey where I knew, based on his, you know, multiple descriptions of the trip to me, that he could not stop. We were taking hairpin curves along the base of the Rocky Mountains. You're on two-lane roads. There were no guardrails. In those days, there were for me. But in any case, we ended up making it as far as Yuma, Arizona, and I felt such tremendous empathy for what he had had to go through, because we had no trouble at all at the time that we went, which was around 2000, and we had no trouble finding a place at all. He, of course, had not had that luxury in the early 1950s, and he had had to drive all the way through. It's a miracle he made it at all. This was very much the reality for any African American making the crossing at that era. There really simply were no places for them to stop. There was extreme segregation to the degree that there were these green books that people had to turn to in order to give them clues as to where they might stay. They were kind of like a AAA map that would give them suggestions as to where they might stay. They had to essentially plan for the idea that they might not be able to stop. They had to be able to ensure that they had enough water and ice for the radiator if it overheated. They needed to make sure they had enough food to last them for the long trip. They often carried their Bibles with them to read the 121st Psalm, which was a prayer to protect basically pilgrims who were making some long journey. They really were on their own. Before GPS, it was before cell phones. It's actually quite frightening to think about what they had to undergo in order to just get to these receiving stations of the North and West.
It was, in every sense, a kind of underground railroad in modern times.
I call it the overground railroad.
No wonder there are so many train songs. I think of Duke Ellington's train songs. There are lots of them, including Take the A-Train, but Daybreak Express, for example.
Even if they didn't take the train, it became a symbol of the way of getting out, and it became the determining factor of where people would go, because they were following the routes of the trains, following the routes of the buses, and ultimately they determined, those railroads determined, those trains determined where people would ultimately go. These were not haphazard arrivals. These people were following very set routes to a different place from wherever they happened to be in the South.
Isabel Wilkerson, you write a wonderful line about the migration as the first big step the nation's servant class took without asking. But it was not without brutal pressure in almost all of these stories, as you said, of lynching or direct threats of murder or imprisonment. Could we listen to Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit, which was, of course, about lynching? Thank you.
during the decades leading up to the Great Migration and following into the Depression, there was a lynching every 3 days in some part of the South. So the strange fruit she described would have been a more common sight than one might think. One historian said that to have been black in the South during that era would have meant that almost all of them would have either known someone in their town who had been lynched or would have heard of someone nearby who had been lynched. It would have been impossible to avoid hearing about that growing up in the South at that time.
Hmm. What was the Wilkerson family story in all this?
Yes.
Your own mother and father?
My mother migrated from Rome, Georgia to Washington, D.C. at the end of World War II as a young woman. And she went to Howard University where she met my father, who was a Tuskegee Airman, and he had come up from Southern Virginia. So they would never, ever have met had there been no Great Migration. I grew up around people who were all the children of people from North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia. I was surrounded by the Great Migration, yet no one called it that. And my parents got me at a school that was on the other side of the park, meaning an integrated school, and she went to a great deal of trouble in order to get me there. She actually made arrangements with a cab company to take me across town to this school where there were many, many children from who were the children of senators and children of ambassadors. So they were, in many respects, immigrant children. And I really found that I had so much in common with the children of the immigrants. And that was because we all had food that our mothers had prepared for our lunch boxes that was so different from the food of the people who'd been there for so much longer. I had this obsession with liverwurst on pumpernickel for a long time because my mother never prepared that for me. In fact, a poet in the South described me as a Southerner once removed because in some ways I felt very much like the child of an immigrant.
You're very, shall we say, generous about connecting this story with all the other immigrations that have formed this country. I mean, what are the common threads, and in what sense is the Great Migration completely a story unto itself?
Well, it's completely a story unto itself because it happened within the borders of this country, and the people who were participants in it were, in fact, American citizens who should not have had to have crossed mountains and gone halfway across the country to experience the privileges that come with being American, the privileges which they were born to. There was no question that they had to leave a caste system that was so arcane that it made it illegal for a black person and a white person to play checkers together in Birmingham, for example, or that there was a black Bible and a white Bible to swear to tell the truth on in many courtrooms throughout the South.
When you read that passage on page 113, in the warmth of other suns, about the signals of control and the rules of the old white South.
Yes, any African American boarding a bus, and it was slightly different in each city or town as to how elaborate the dance was of just boarding a bus. Sometimes they would buy the ticket and then have to get off the bus and go to the back of the bus. Sometimes they could buy the ticket and then go straight through the white section in order to get to the black section. But either way, there was always some signal, some sign that would indicate this part of the bus is for whites, this part of the bus is for blacks. And on this particular bus that the protagonist, Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, was boarding as he was heading north to St. Louis, they kept moving the sign as white people boarded, and only the white people could touch the sign. So if you would like me to read it, it reads, "Those white and colored shingles were as much a part of the southern landscape as cotton growing in the field. Each state and city had a different requirement or custom to signal how the races were to be separated and to what extent the races were to be divided. In North Carolina, white and colored passengers could not occupy, quote, contiguous seats on the same bench, unquote. Virginia prohibited the two races from sitting side by side on the same bench unless all other seats were filled. Several states required that the placard saying white or colored be, quote, in plain letters, not less than 2 inches high. In Houston, the race to which the seat belonged was posted on the back of the seat. In Georgia, the penalty for willfully riding in the wrong seat was a fine of $1,000 or 6 months in prison. Colored passengers were assigned to the front of the rail car on the train, but to the rear of other conveyances too. In the words of the mayor of Birmingham, do away with the, quote, disagreeable odors that would necessarily follow the breezes.
Mm. So what does the Great Migration have in common with the Irish, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans, Jews, you name it?
I really believe that one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that many of the groups that were converging in these big cities of the North, these great dream cities of that attracted so many people from all over the world and from the southern part of the United States, the tragedy was that the people were essentially the same. Many of them were people of the land, people who had worked the land, people who were coming from small towns, often repressive caste systems that they were from which they were seeking freedom in the new world of America as we know it. And yet when they arrived, one group was allowed to join the unions, recruited to join the unions. Others were brought in as strike breakers. Some were allowed to live in many, many different neighborhoods of their choosing. Others were limited to particular already overcrowded sections that became ghettos. They never imagine all the wonderful and amazing things, relationships and friendships and alliances that could have been made had these people not been torn apart and rendered rivals as opposed to people who might have worked together and made friendships and had greater understanding. Perhaps some of the violence that attended the arrival of the migrants to the North might not have occurred had there been a greater understanding that they were all the same people and had so much more in common. Any immigrant who makes this journey is different from those who stay, by definition. They are more likely to be risk takers. They are less patient with the status quo. They're less likely to be able to accept the repression of the place that they're leaving. They're more likely to be able to say, I can make the break from all that I've known for a place that I've never seen, even without the guarantees and hopes that life will be better. That is a classic American story.
And in my case, it was illiterate Irish peasants from the West in Galway who arrived around 1895 and signed with an X. I mean, it's astonishing.
It is astonishing. It is the classic American story, and if people recognize that when they said that, you know, when the migration began, 90% of all African Americans were living in the South. By the end of the Great Migration, half were living outside of the South, this great arc from Boston to over to Chicago and then over to the West Coast down to Los Angeles. And that means that the majority of African Americans that you meet, just as when you think of a majority of Americans that you might meet, all were descended from people who came from someplace far away, far from where they happen to be, and often these forebears met someone that they would have otherwise never met, created a whole new lineage in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, in Los Angeles, and started whole new family lines, which is how you get a Michelle Obama.
We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, the journalist and author of The Warmth of Other Suns. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. I'm Christopher Lydon. We'll be right back.
And welcome back. You just listened to part one of The Great Migration with Isabel Wilkerson discussing the political, social, and cultural implications of the migration of millions of African Americans from the southern United States to other regions, more industrialized regions of the country, in the East, the Northeast, the Midwest, as well as the West. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. And right now, let's listen in to part two of The Great Migration, featuring Isabel Wilkerson, a renowned researcher who has looked extensively into the migration patterns and their impact on the culture of both the African-American people as well as U.S. society in general.
We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. I'm Christopher Lydon. Isabel Wilkerson, we're talking about the setting out and what that took, but then there was the getting there. You refer to the North, both East and West, in the book, it's referred to as the kinder mistress. But these were difficult receptions in Chicago, in New York, even in Los Angeles. Tell some of that story about the fear, again, the threat of violence, but also the amazingly foresighted Chicago Commission on Race Relations right around World War I.
Yes. Again, as I was saying about the great tragedy, is there was great fear, misunderstanding, suspicion, and wariness about the arrival of African Americans in such large numbers. In the case of a family called the Clarks, as they attempted to move into this apartment building in Cicero, Illinois, just on the western border of Chicago, they were so excited to have found this apartment because they had been living in a two-room apartment with another family. So basically, you had like 10 people living in a two-room flat on the south side of Chicago for a huge amount of money. They found a cheaper apartment, 5 rooms, and they were so excited to move in. When they tried to move in, they were not permitted to by the sheriff. They had to get a court order in order to move in. Eventually, when they were able to move in, they could move their belongings in, but they themselves could move in. The night that their belongings were moved in, a mob of several thousand gathered around them. And of course, these were sadly immigrants who had just arrived not long before themselves, and they gathered around and they stormed the apartment, the second floor apartment, threw out the sofa, the chairs, the piano, all of their belongings, the children's pictures, the wedding pictures, all of that they threw out the second floor window. Then they went and tore out the radiators, the sinks, the fixtures, the faucets, and threw all of them out the window as well. Then they set the pile of belongings on fire. Then they set the building on fire, which then left the white residents who were living in the building homeless.
Mm.
That was the early 50s.
Even in New York, this is 1963, your man George Starling, up from Citrus, Florida, is wondering what in the world he's done. Can I read this paragraph?
Yes.
George Swanson Starling, 1963, New York. Something welled up in George. Everything raced before him. The cheating foreman in the groves, his running for his life, the hangings and burnings, the little southern dog that would rather die than be black, the bomb going off on Christmas Day under the bed of a good man trying to bring justice to Florida. And then there was New York, wide open and stifling at the same time. Yes, he was alive, but it was a slow death in a hard city. He was a baggage handler, for all intents and purposes, and would be no more than that, no matter how much potential he had.
Yes, it was a difficult adjustment to what he had hoped would be a fuller life, and it turned out that the North was not what he expected it to be. Yes, he was freer to do certain things, but there would arise a moment where Jim Crow seemed to be following him. And one of those cases was where he had gotten back from a long run on the train. And he always used to look forward to coming to the North because it was always less stress just being in the North. I mean, he didn't have to worry about, getting on the bad side of a sheriff just because he didn't say sir. I mean, it was just a freer world in so many ways. And so he always felt relaxed when he got back to New York. However, this time he went to get a drink at a bar near Penn Station, which is where he operated out of as a railroad porter. And they stopped at the bar, got their glass of beer. After they finished them, they set the glasses down. The bartender quietly and without comment took the glasses and smashed them against the counter where all the other patrons looked and could see that what the bartender had done was that he had broken the glasses because if they had touched the lips of a person who was black, they were no longer fit to be used by anyone else. And that stayed with him and reminded him that there could still be moments when he could be reminded of the caste that he had been born into, even in New York.
Isabel Wilkerson, can I ask you, just as a matter of method, who elicited all these stories? Did you do all the interviews on all your principal subjects, or what? I mean, the stories themselves, the storytellers are so brilliantly chosen and then given so much encouragement here.
I conducted interviews with over 1,200 people. In the course of doing the interviews with these people, I had a researcher who was helping me track down the best places to go to find them. I went to AARP meetings. I went to senior centers. I went to Baptist churches, Catholic mass. I went to churches in New York where everyone was from South Carolina. I mean, I went to high school reunions and all kinds of places where it could be thought that people who had migrated would be, senior citizens would be. And so I had help with some of the initial interviewing, but the relationships with and the interviews with the three main characters were by me. I went to the South with two of the three people. Robert Foster had no desire to go back, so he did not. But Ida Mae Gladney and George Swanson Starling did agree to go back. And, you know, I had a wonderful experience with Ida Mae Gladney in particular, who, when we got to cotton fields, she actually wanted to stop and pick some. I mean, she hadn't wanted to pick when she was a sharecropper, but now that she didn't have to and we got there and she hadn't been to Mississippi in decades and she saw it and something made her feel like she wanted to get out. So I said, are you sure we can pick in this field? I mean, this land belongs to somebody. And besides that, we're in Mississippi. And she said, oh, they won't care what little bit we're about to pick. And so we got out there. We spent maybe 10 minutes, you know, just I had never even seen cotton growing before. But it was, you know, she went out there and I got out there and I took pictures and some of them would be on the website. And she just enjoyed it. And then we got back in the car and we went on about our way to visit some of the people that she knew or those that we could find. So
she was how old by then?
She was in her 80s. She was in her late 80s by then. But she had the energy to get out there, jump out of the car and go out into that field.
Let's talk about the hard part, as these lives approach their ends, and you see them all to their graves in this book, their lives in some were difficult, and their next generation was even more troubled in certain ways. Start with Ida Mae, who lived peacefully in Chicago, surrounded by family and her church and her work, but surrounded also by crime like crazy on the South Side, dope, helplessness. This is a very grim place to have escaped to.
Yes, it is. I mean, what had happened was she and her family, like many immigrants actually, decided that they would move as multiple generations into a three flat, meaning an apartment building with three actual apartments in it, and it would be three generations that would be living in this one apartment building. And they thought it was wonderful. It was a lovely Italian family that sold the house to them. But within months, the neighborhood had turned from all white to completely black. And in doing so, so did the bakery left, the ice cream parlor left, all of those things that make for a neighborhood left as the proprietors left as well. And then they were replaced with liquor stores and payday loan places. That it happened so quickly that the neighborhood was really never able to recover. No one wanted to invest in the neighborhood anymore, and then she found herself surrounded by people who were no longer owners because the turnover had happened so quickly, and she was surrounded by people who ultimately might have been dealing drugs or in gangs, and she found that was what had occurred to the neighborhood that she had so loved when she first arrived. Oddly enough, though, she was such a warm and loving person that even they liked her, and they looked out for her, and they would warn her to stay inside because we're going to be shooting this afternoon.
Oh, Lord. But she looks out her window at tremendous degradation. It's a very sad scene. Talk about George Starling, who had an unhappy marriage, children in and out of wedlock, but a tragic adventure with drugs in the next generation.
He is an example of how the children, because he and his wife were working so hard, it's my contention that one of the things that happened to this next generation was several things. One is their parents were extraordinarily hard workers. And because they were hard workers, they were not always able to be there when the children got out of school. Secondly, they had come from small towns where they were surrounded by neighbors and friends and family, and even though life was very difficult because of Jim Crow, they still had, there were lots of eyes and ears watching out for their children. Here, that wasn't the case. And they were not accustomed to the dangers of the North. They could not even anticipate or have the idea of what might be happening out there in the streets. They couldn't fathom what was happening. They did not anticipate how bad it could be in these crowded, overcrowded, dangerous streets that were drawing in their children. And he was one who essentially lost his son and, in a way, his daughter to the streets of New York.
And then finally, among your big three, there's Dr. Foster. Ray Charles's Dr. Foster in that song, Hide No Hair. He has a very successful private practice for a while. He ends up kind of willy-nilly in a VA medical center under a lot of bureaucratic pressure and maybe racial disdain too. His heart is weakening before he dies. He's in trouble at the end. But the thing I'd like you to dwell on, Isabel, is that all of these three migrants come to a point in their lives when they are asking themselves, would they have been better off in the South?
They do ask themselves that. We would talk about that quite a bit. And it turned out that they would all have said, and they all did say, they would say that we've made many mistakes in our lives, but leaving the South was not one of them.
And do you agree?
I would absolutely agree, because in some ways, however you want to define success, for them, remembering what they were leaving, remembering the world of Bill Russell's parents, remembering the world that they were living in, even though life was not perfect, they had such modest goals. They were not looking to run Fortune 500 companies and to own skyscrapers. They were looking to be able to get in line, get gas in the order in which they had arrived. They were looking to be able to have their children be able to go to a school where they could actually take a book out of the library. They had very modest goals. So when you think about the modest goals of these people who were like, any immigrant group who might have come here just wanting to be able to, to survive in the new world in hopes that life might be better. In some ways, leaving was its own point. Getting out was its own point. This migration helped to lead, we've talked about literature, high literature, we've talked about music, we've talked about sports. But politically, this migration was huge because many of the states of the North and the West, which we consider to be blue states, are blue states in part because of this transfer of people who had never voted before but now were in the North and the West and were able to vote, and they ended up voting as Democrats, loyal blue people, you might say, often. That was one thing. Secondly, this great migration in some ways paved the way for the civil rights movement, or the human rights movement, as I like to call it, which then led the way to other freedom movements for women and for other groups. And that was because the people who left showed that the members of this lower caste system that had been defined by Jim Crow in the South had options that it did not have before, and they were willing to act upon them. Secondly, these people provided leverage for those who stayed and were the ones who were bearing up under the sheriff's dogs and those hoses. And they provided a kind of leverage because these people who had to fight that final battle for civil rights, they knew that there was a place that they could go if things got too difficult for them. They knew that there was also another way. They had not been exposed to the options of the North. The options of the North didn't exist for them before the Great Migration occurred. And so the migration provided leverage for those who stayed and fought the final battle. And then finally, the people who left also provided financing for the civil rights movement and for the people in the South who were depending on it. How typical is it of the immigrant to want to take care of those back home because they're making more money up in the North and they would send money back. And that helped to also fuel the effort toward civil rights and the legislation that actually changed finally the South and made it a place where now the children and grandchildren of the Great Migration can participate in what's called a reverse migration, because the reasons for the original Great Migration had been resolved to a large degree, not completely, but to a great degree.
Let's go out on the Count Basie Band, if we may. So many children of the Great Migration in the band playing Midnight Blue. Can I give you one, my own reader's definition of the victory here?
Yes, I'd love to hear it.
Well, you know, I just keep thinking in all of these stories vindicate the genius of the individual, of human gifts when given opportunity, and the fruits that are sort of waiting there to be recognized. And it also speaks incredibly well overall, it seems to me, over the span of a century and hundreds, thousands, millions of lives, about the process of adaptation in this country. One of the things I kept thinking was, if China and India, in their own processes of fantastically huge migration now, if they come out of the process with individuals that will have changed their cultures as expressively and as profoundly, even for the whole world to notice and enjoy, as the Black Americans of the 20th century did, they'll be very lucky. I mean, it is a marvelous record overall, it seems to me, of a country and a culture dealing with the challenge to recognize unrecognized people, to touch the untouchables, and then to deal with them and to hear from them in glory.
You're absolutely right. I think that the world will be lucky if we can see a similar outgrowth and outpouring of artistic expression and other kinds of expression, because ultimately this was a leaderless revolution in which the individuals defied their own leaders who had told them, stay in the South, this is the land of the forefathers, this is the land that our forefathers worked for free, and we must stay here and maintain our role here because this is where we belong. The people didn't listen to it. The people went out and did exactly what their hearts told them to do, and that meant that, as you described it, the genius of the individual, the power of the individual. To me, it's an inspiration to everyone who is the descendant of someone who participated in this or any other migration experience, and that is that if they could do that, then what is it that we can do? There's nothing that we can't do if you think of it that way. What a legacy they've left for all of us. What a legacy they've left of courage and great heart. Great heart. I get filled with inspiration just thinking about it, and I have such a more enormous gratitude for my parents for what they did and for all of these people and for anyone who would participate in, who would leave a place so far away for some place that they'd never seen. I'm just filled with gratitude.
Isabel Wilkerson, I'm grateful to you for telling such an extraordinary story so beautifully. I hadn't quite realized that you did all the interviewing yourself. It's a phenomenal accomplishment and a deeply moving one at any level, in any part of the world, to think of migrants in this frame. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you. Thank you for the warmth of Other Suns. Thank you for the warmth of this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation with Isabel Wilkerson. Her book is The Warmth of Other Suns. Listeners, please finish up the conversation with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of this conversation.
And welcome back. This is the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. We just heard a two-part audio documentary series featuring Isabel Wilkerson on the history of the so-called Great Migration, the movement of Africans in the United States from the South decades after the conclusion of slavery and Reconstruction, the imposition of Jim Crow, the Black Codes, and other forms of legalized segregation, lynchings, and, of course, contract labor systems, which in many ways reimposed the antebellum slave system. People who left those areas of the United States to move to more urban and more industrialized areas of the country beginning during the second decade of the 20th century. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Ezekwe. Today is Monday, September the 1st, 2014. We're broadcasting live from our studios here in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to the Pan-African Journal for this week. And, of course, the Pan-African Journal can be accessed, this program, as well as other archived programs of the Pan-African Journal, can be accessed by merely logging on to the Pan-African Radio Network. And the Pan-African Radio Network, of course, can be accessed by going to the following URL. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And by logging on to that website, you can not only have access to this program, but other programs from the Pan-African Journal. We want to encourage all of our listeners to share this program with other potential listeners. This can be done through the utilization of emails. The program, the MP3 podcast of the program can be emailed to other potential listeners. It can also be put up on other blogs and websites as well. It can also be shared through social media networks such as Facebook and Twitter. We want to get this information out as broadly as possible. And, of course, we will continue with the Pan-African Journal. And we'd like to remind our listeners that today is Labor Day inside the United States. And in the city of Detroit, there's the ongoing Detroit International Jazz Festival, which is going to conclude this evening. And the evening performance will include a concert by legendary jazz electronic bassist Stanley Clark, who came to international notoriety during the 1970s. And, of course, we will be there covering the work of Stanley Clark. And, of course, right now we're going to take another brief musical break. We'll be right back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week. And welcome back. This is Abayomi Ezekwe. We just heard the sound of Art Farmer with the tune entitled Mau Mau. And before that, we heard a two-part audio documentary series featuring Isabel Wilkerson on the Great Migration of African Americans, doing the first two-thirds decades of the 20th century. And we're going to be winding down the Pan-African Journal for this week. We'd like to remind all of our listeners that if you want to have access to this program as well as other archived editions of the Pan-African Journal, all you have to do is log on to the Pan-African Radio Network. And that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And if you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, all you have to do is go to the website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And you can, of course, listen in to the contents of this program again, as well as other programs over the Pan-African Journal through the Pan-African Radio Network. And this is Abayomi Ezekwe. And we're going to be closing out with the music of Miles Davis. Last evening, jazz trumpeter Wallace Rooney presented a tribute to Miles Davis featuring songs written by and arranged by Wayne Shorter, who was a part of the Miles Davis Quintet and also performed with Miles Davis in the subsequent years of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And we're going to close out with the music of Miles Davis. We'd like to thank once again all of our listeners for tuning in. We'll be back in the days to come with more programming from the Pan-African Journal. This is Abayomi Ezekwe signing off, and have a beautiful week. Thank you.